Welcome, everyone, to The Deep Dive. I'm Alex Johnson, your guide, ready to dig into the developments really shaping things.
And I'm Sam Kennedy, here to help connect those dots and add some context. Great to have you with us today.
Today, we're jumping into a really crucial deep dive. We're calling it the Federal News Update for Tuesday, September 16th, 2025.
And our goal here really is to give you the full picture, a comprehensive, thorough, you know, exhaustive look at everything the U.S. federal government has been up to since the start of September 15th, 2025.
Exactly. And we want to discuss the impact, the implications, really get into the granular details. It's been a really packed 48 hours.
Absolutely packed. We're talking everything from domestic law enforcement, some pretty assertive foreign policy moves, big economic shifts, institutional, well, upheavals, frankly.
And critical changes to the federal workforce, too. We're going to try and navigate all these complexities, pull out the key facts, maybe some surprising ones, and help you understand what truly matters in this flood of information.
Let's dive in.
Okay, so let's start with the executive branch. A really significant domestic move right off the bat on September 15th. President Donald J. Trump signed a presidential memorandum. It establishes something called the Memphis Safe Task Force.
Yeah, this is a big one. And what's really striking is the justification the administration put forward.
Right.
The White House framed it as a direct response to, and this is their phrase, rampant crime in Memphis, Tennessee. They basically claimed the city's local government was overwhelmed, couldn't handle it.
So the memorandum authorizes a multi-agency task force, pulling people from various federal law enforcement agencies.
But here's where it gets, well, pretty unprecedented, I think. The directive specifically tasks the Secretary of War.
And that title itself is significant, given the recent renaming of DOD?
Exactly. It tasks the Secretary of War with requesting the mobilization of Tennessee National Guard units.
Mobilizing the Guard.
Mm-hmm. And it even encourages seeking personnel from other states' National Guards, too.
Wow.
And they're not hiding the playbook here. They explicitly modeled this intervention on a similar federal crackdown they did earlier in Washington, D.C.
Which the administration has been calling a success, right?
Consistently, yes. So this isn't just sending in, you know, FBI agents or marshals. This is about deploying military forces domestically.
Under what seems like a, well, a novel interpretation of federal power.
Absolutely. And a core piece of this is how they're using data, or maybe how they're framing data. The White House justification paints a really grim picture of Memphis.
Okay.
Citing, you know, high rates of murder, robbery, assault. They even made these really stark comparisons.
Like what?
They said Memphis's murder rate is about 4 times higher than Mexico City's.
Okay, that's striking.
And get this, 27 times higher than Havana's.
27 times.
Yeah.
Wow.
So that narrative, it's clearly designed to create this sense of, you know, dire urgency, justifying the need for federal action, setting the stage.
But, and this is a big but, that official narrative seems to directly contradict local data.
That's right. Just days before the president's announcement, the Memphis Police Department released its own statistics.
And what did they say?
They reported historic crime reductions across every major category for the first 8 months of 2025.
Historic reduction. So the opposite of rampant crime.
Pretty much. Their data showed overall crime in the city was actually at a 25-year low.
25-year low.
And the murder rate, a 6-year low.
Okay. So that factual discrepancy is huge.
Yeah.
It really suggests the federal action might be driven by something else, maybe a broader political strategy, not just a direct response to what's happening on the ground right now.
Exactly. And if you connect the dots, look at the bigger picture, this isn't happening in a vacuum, right?
Yeah. Oh.
It follows similar deployments in D.C., Los Angeles, and there's been public talk, you know, considerations of intervention in other cities run by Democrats, Chicago, Baltimore, New Orleans.
So it looks like a pattern, a strategic use of federal power, maybe, to assert authority over urban centers governed by political opponents.
Yeah.
Using crime as the justification.
That's certainly how it appears. It seems like a strategic blueprint for asserting federal control, setting a precedent for more centralized authority.
And the impact on the ground.
Yeah.
It seems to be creating a deep divide, especially this conflict between state and local officials.
Oh, absolutely. Tennessee's Republican Governor Bill Lee, he fully supported the intervention, stood with the president at the signing, expressed gratitude for federal resources.
And other state-level Republicans followed suit, senators, representatives.
Yep, echoed that support. But then you look locally.
Big contrast.
Huge contrast. Memphis's Democratic mayor, Paul Young, he went public saying, look, I did not request the National Guard. I don't think it's effective for crime reduction. And crucially, this decision was made without my consent.
Made without his consent. That's pretty pointed.
And Shelby County Mayor Lee Harris, even stronger language. He called the deployment disappointing, anti-democratic, and violates American norms and possibly U.S. laws.
Wow. Violates U.S. laws. Is he taking action?
He said he's actively exploring legal options to try and prevent it. So, yeah, this raises really critical questions about federal power versus local self-governance, especially when local leaders feel completely overridden.
Beyond the politics, though, what about the practicalities, the resources?
That's another major concern, resource strain. Even before this federal announcement, the state had sent in a bunch of Tennessee Highway Patrol officers.
Really?
And that influx already led to a surge in arrests, which put immense pressure on the Shelby County Jail. Apparently, it's severely overcrowded.
How bad is it?
Reports were saying hundreds of people were being held in intake rooms because there just wasn't space.
Hundreds? Ah. Just in intake?
Right. So now, officials are really worried that deploying the National Guard will just make this crisis worse, potentially overwhelming the county budget, the jail capacity, staffing. It could become unsustainable. It's like a domino effect.
And what about the people living in Memphis? How's the community reacting?
Well, Memphis is a majority black city. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, this announcement has stoked very real fear and anxiety.
Right. Understandably.
Residents, local leaders like State Representative Justin Pearson, they've expressed really deep concern about, and this is their term, the weaponization of the military against black communities.
That's strong language. Weaponization.
It is. It evokes these historical parallels, this specter of their neighborhoods becoming a militarized zone. So it's creating this significant civil liberties concern, a climate of distrust.
So the deeper insight here is that this intervention, whatever its stated goal, might actually be creating more insecurity and a sense of injustice within the very community it's supposed to protect.
Precisely. It's a really complex and troubling situation on the ground there.
Okay. So shifting from domestic intervention to foreign policy, another significant action on September 15th, a U.S. military strike on a Venezuelan vessel.
Yeah, and this wasn't the first. It was the second lethal strike by the U.S. military in about 2 weeks against a vessel in international waters.
And the administration's claim was
that the vessel was transporting illicit drugs from Venezuela. This specific strike killed 3 people on board.
Yeah.
And the previous one?
That one killed 11 people. So we're talking multiple fatalities in these operations.
Did the president comment directly?
He did. President Trump personally confirmed it, defended the action, told reporters, quite bluntly, "We have proof. All you have to do is look at the cargo that was spattered all over the ocean. Big bags of cocaine and fentanyl all over the place."
Spattered all over the ocean. Graphic.
Very. The White House also released a video of the strike itself. And Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth put out a warning on social media saying the U.S. would track them, kill them, and dismantle their network.
Track them, kill them. That's unusually direct language for a defense secretary.
Extremely direct. And this whole thing, it really represents a major shift, a paradigm shift, you could say.
How so?
While this military action marks a huge escalation in how the U.S. handles counter-narcotics, it's moving away from, you know, traditional law enforcement interdiction, seizing boats, making arrests, towards the overt use of lethal military force.
And how are they justifying that legally?
Well, the administration has laid the groundwork by designating certain Venezuelan drug trafficking organizations, they specifically cited Tren de Aragua, as terrorist groups.
Reclassifying them.
Exactly. And that reclassification is key. It lets them argue these actions aren't just law enforcement, they're national security, self-defense against narco-terrorists who pose an immediate threat to the U.S.
So that reframing allows them to bypass a lot of the usual legal constraints on law enforcement.
That seems to be the strategy, yes. It sidesteps jurisdictional issues, rules of engagement that normally apply.
And did the president indicate this approach might be used more broadly?
He did. Explicitly suggested this new doctrine could be expanded. He said cartels smuggling drugs by land would be stopped the same way we stopped the boats.
Wow. So potentially using military force against smugglers on the border, too.
That's the implication. The insight here is really profound. This isn't just about drugs anymore. It's a redefinition of national security threats. It's a major test of the executive's war powers, and it could set a really dangerous international precedent.
The impact sounds enormous, both internationally and domestically.
Definitely. Geopolitically, Venezuela's government is unsurprisingly furious. They've vehemently condemned the strikes.
What do they say?
President Nicolas Maduro accused the Trump administration of using drug trafficking as a pretext, a cover for a military operation aimed at intimidation and regime change.
So this just pours gasoline on an already fiery relationship.
Absolutely. It poisons relations further, risks broader conflict in the Caribbean, escalates already high tensions in the region.
And domestically, you mentioned a constitutional crisis.
Yes. Using the armed forces for lethal strikes against non-state actors, essentially in a law enforcement context, has set off alarm bells in Congress on both sides of the aisle.
Bipartisan concern.
Yes. A group of senators raising concerns about executive overreach, about usurping Congress's power to authorize war.
Is Congress pushing back?
Democratic Senator Adam Schiff is reportedly drafting a war powers resolution, specifically to try and halt further strikes unless Congress explicitly approves them. He's warning this could lead to an unauthorized war with Venezuela.
And human rights groups.
They're weighing in, too. Amnesty International USA, for example, criticized the strike as potential extrajudicial execution, which is murder.
Murder. Strong words.
They argue there's absolutely no legal justification for this type of legal action outside a recognized armed conflict. So, yeah, deep legal and ethical questions being raised by this new doctrine.
Okay, so alongside these pretty confrontational actions, the government was also continuing its more, let's say, conventional foreign policy work on September 15th. Arms sales, naval exercises.
Exactly. Business as usual in some ways. The State Department approved two pretty significant foreign military sales.
What were they?
A potential $3.42 billion sale to Peru. That includes 12 F-16 Block 70 aircraft, engines, missiles, lots of logistical support.
$3.4 billion, that's substantial.
It is. And also a $567.8 million sale to Belgium for AIM-9X Sidewinder air-to-air missiles and related equipment.
Sidewinders for Belgium.
Okay.
And the naval exercise.
Right. At the same time, the U.S. Navy and U.S. Naval Forces Southern Command U.S. 4th Fleet kicked off UNITAS 2025 down at Naval Station Mayport in Florida.
UNITAS. That sounds familiar.
It should. It's actually the 66th iteration. It's the world's longest-running multinational maritime exercise. Really enduring.
66. Wow. And it's big.
Massive. About 8,000 personnel involved. Ships, submarines, aircraft from 25 allied and partner nations.
25 nations. That's quite a coalition.
It is. The theme this year is Legacy of Maritime Partnerships, and it's also kicking off celebrations for the U.S. Navy's 250th birthday.
Navy's turning 250.
Yeah.
Big milestone. So these activities, the arms sales, UNITAS, they represent the more traditional side of foreign policy.
Wait. Exactly. The day-to-day execution of U.S. foreign and defense policy, strengthening alliances, making sure militaries can work together, you know, interoperability, and of course, supporting the U.S. defense industrial base.
How are these sales justified specifically? Peru, for example.
The justification for Peru is framed as improving the security of an important partner for stability and economic progress in South America, specifically enhancing their ability to control airspace, support counter-narcotics, counter-terrorism ops.
And Belgium.
That's framed as a direct contribution to NATO's collective defense, improving the capability of a key ally's F-35 fleet. These aren't the dramatic headlines, but they're the steady drumbeat of diplomacy and defense alliances.
So the insight here is that even while some policies are causing major waves, this business as usual, diplomacy and defense cooperation continues, projecting stability and influence.
Precisely. It maintains global stability, reinforces the U.S. role, and the impact is multifaceted. It solidifies the U.S. as a key security partner for allies. It creates long-term technological dependencies, which ensures interoperability.
And it's good business for defense contractors.
Absolutely. Sustained business for companies like Lockheed Martin, General Electric Aerospace, RTX Corporation, and UNITAS, that large-scale exercise. It's a powerful demonstration of commitment to freedom of navigation, responding to common threats. It's soft power projection, essentially.
Okay, so while the executive branch was making these big moves, the quieter machinery of government kept grinding away too, right?
Yeah.
Legislative, regulatory stuff on September 15th.
Absolutely. The gears keep turning. The U.S. Senate, for instance, was in session for over 5 hours. They conducted 3 roll call votes.
Anything significant pass?
Yes. The confirmation of Steven Marin to be a member of the Board of Governors of the Federal Reserve System. That passed, but narrowly, 48-47.
A Fed governor confirmation. That's a big deal for the economy down the line.
Huge implications. Meanwhile, over in the House, committees were busy with hearings. The Veterans Affairs Subcommittee on Technology Modernization held one called Advancing VA Care Through Artificial Intelligence.
AI and VA care.
Interesting.
Mm-hmm. And the federal bureaucracy itself, always busy. 121 new documents published in the Federal Register just on that day.
121 documents. Wow. Anything stand out?
Well, there was a notice of proposed rulemaking, an NPRM, from the FAA, the Federal Aviation Administration.
Okay, an NPRM. That's basically the government saying, we're thinking about this new rule. What do you think?
Exactly. It's a proposal open for public comment. In this case, the FAA is proposing a new airworthiness directive, basically a mandatory safety update for a specific type of engine.
Which engine?
All Rolls-Royce Deutschland model RB211 Trent 7 series engines. These are used on some wide-body aircraft.
And why the directive? What's the issue?
It was prompted by reports that low-pressure compressor blades in these engines are prone to cracking.
Cracking blades. That sounds serious.
It is. If it's not fixed, it could lead to some pretty severe consequences. In-flight engine shutdown, engine fire, even uncontained debris release. That means engine parts flying out. A major safety risk.
Yeah, definitely something you want to prevent.
Absolutely. And the impact of all these seemingly routine activities, it just underscores how vast and continuous the federal government's operation is, right? Often happening below the radar.
For sure. The Fed governor confirmation, as we said, huge long-term impact on monetary policy. Interest rates, inflation, economic stability stuff that affects your wallet directly.
Right. And the House hearing on AI and VA care, that's critical oversight. Grappling with how new tech impacts public services, both the opportunities and the challenges.
And the FAA proposing that engine safety rule is a perfect example of that essential, non-political, technical work regulatory agencies do to keep the public safe.
Exactly. It's such a contrast to the highly charged executive actions we were just discussing. It shows the different layers of federal governance all operating simultaneously, even when politics are turbulent. The insight is that this foundational work of government, it just keeps going, often unnoticed, but with really profound effects on everyday life.
It's easy to focus on the headlines, the big policy decisions. But we have to remember this huge government machine is run by actual people. Federal employees.
That's right. And this past week, those people, the federal workforce, saw some really significant, almost seismic shifts.
Let's start with a major court ruling. This actually came down September 13th, updated on the 14th, but the ripples were felt strongly on the 15th and 16th. U.S. District Court Judge William Alsup ruled that the Office of Personnel Management, OPM.
OPM, the government's HR agency, essentially.
Right. Judge Alsup found OPM unlawfully directed agencies to fire under false pretense about 25,000 probationary federal employees back around mid-February.
25,000 people, that's a staggering number. And unlawfully directed false pretense, that's incredibly strong language from a federal judge.
It really is. Judge Alsup explicitly said OPM had exceeded its own powers. That it directed agencies to fire under false pretense, telling these new employees they were being let go for poor performance or misconduct when that wasn't necessarily true.
And the judge was clear. OPM made the call, not the individual agencies.
Yes. The ruling stated OPM decided who to fire, and OPM decided when to fire. He declared the whole directive unlawful. The insight here seems to be this wasn't just agencies making individual HR decisions. It was a centralized, legally questionable purge directed by OPM.
So what does this ruling actually mean for those 25,000 fired employees? Do they get their jobs back?
That's the crucial part. No, it does not reinstate any of them.
Why not? If the firing was unlawful.
Well, the Supreme Court had already ruled back in July that the Trump administration has pretty broad authority to reshape and shrink the federal workforce. And Judge Alsup himself noted that, realistically, many of those employees have likely moved on, found other jobs, and the agencies themselves have changed since February. Reinstatement just wasn't seen as practical.
Okay, so no jobs back. What does the ruling do then?
It directs many of the agencies involved, commerce, defense, HHS, labor, treasury, transportation, agriculture, to update their personnel records by November 14.
Update them.
To specifically state that these employees were not fired for poor performance or misconduct, essentially clearing their record on that front.
That's important for future job prospects.
Definitely. Agencies also have to send official letters to the affected employees telling them they weren't fired for performance reasons.
Are all agencies covered?
No, there are exemptions. OPM itself, NASA, the State Department, and the Office of Management and Budget, OMB, are exempt from this part of the order.
Interesting. And the judge made it clear agencies can still fire people.
Yes. Judge Alsup clarified, Nothing in this order prohibits any federal agency from terminating any employee so long as the agency makes that decision on its own, does not use the OPM template termination notice, and is otherwise in compliance with applicable law.
So the takeaway isn't that agencies can't fire probationary employees, but that OPM's method, the centralized directive using false pretenses, was unlawful. It's a check on how they did it.
Exactly. It's a legal rebuke of OPM's methods, affirming some principles of due process, even if it doesn't restore the jobs.
How did the different sides react, the unions, OPM?
Well, Everett Kelly, the national president of the big federal employee union, AFGE, called it another significant victory for federal employees and for all Americans. He stressed that thousands of probationary workers were wrongfully fired, so the union clearly sees it as validating their position on employee rights.
And OPM, what did Director Kupor say?
OPM Director Scott Kupor wrote a blog post. He cited some recent workforce court cases and basically reiterated the administration's stance, saying, "A central tenet of President Trump's administration is to improve the efficiency and accountability of the federal workforce."
So framing it within their broader agenda, but not directly addressing the unlawful directive part.
Pretty much avoided that specific finding. This whole situation, it really throws a spotlight on big questions about accountability, due process, the limits of executive power in federal hiring and firing, especially for new employees in that probationary period.
Yeah, huge implications for how the government manages its people.
And staying with OPM, there were also some major changes announced regarding how senior executive service members, the SES, are evaluated, their performance reviews.
Right. A new final rule from OPM. It was issued September 12th, but published in the Federal Register on Monday, September 15th. It officially lifts a previous ban on using a forced distribution system for rating the performance of career SES members.
Forced distribution. That sounds like grading on a curve, basically.
That's a good way to think about it. This new system puts a cap, a limit, on how many SES members an agency can rate at the top two levels of the five-level performance system, levels 4 and 5.
So only a certain percentage can get the top ratings.
Exactly. The stated goal is to ensure only the truly deserving performers are rewarded. But importantly, there are no limits on how many can get the lower ratings levels 1, 2, or 3.
OPM argues this is more like the private sector.
That's their argument, yes.
Yeah.
And that it will ensure meaningful distinctions in SES performance ratings, make the ratings mean more, essentially.
This sounds controversial, though. OPM says accountability. But what are the critics saying? Seems like it could really impact morale.
That's definitely the concern. Critics worry it could harm agency culture, maybe stifle innovation. If people are afraid to take risks for fear of not making the top quota, could it make reviews less accurate, more about hitting a number than actual performance?
Could it incentivize managers to just play it safe? Or maybe discourage collaboration if everyone's competing for limited top spots?
Those are absolutely the risks people are pointing out. It can create a kind of zero-sum game. You might have a whole team of genuinely outstanding leaders, but under this system, you couldn't rate them all at the top level. That seems counterintuitive if you want to foster excellence.
Was there anything in the final rule that addressed potential gaming of the system, particularly regarding political appointees versus career staff?
Yes, actually. That was a notable change from the proposed regulations. OPM decided to exclude political appointees within the SES from these forced distribution requirements.
Why the change?
It was to address concerns that agencies might feel pressured or find it easier to give those limited top ratings to political appointees instead of career SES members, maybe regardless of who actually performed better.
So a carve-out for political appointees.
Yeah.
That's interesting. Trying to maintain some semblance of merit for the career service, right?
That seems to be the thinking, yes. A subtle but important tweak.
So reactions overall are mixed. Supporters see inflated ratings needing correction. Critics see damaged culture.
Exactly. Supporters point to OPM's data from 2023 showing something like 96% of SES got top ratings. Less than 0.5% scored below fully successful. They say forced distribution brings needed accountability.
96%. Okay, that does sound high.
It does. But OPM counters the critics by arguing this will improve culture and accuracy, create a high-performance culture where truly exceptional performance will be differentiated from mediocre and poor performance. They even suggested a level 3 rating, fully successful, would start to be seen as a positive thing over time.
We'll see about that. Were there other changes bundled in this rule impacting the SES?
Yes, a couple of significant ones. The rule also removes any parts of performance reviews that assessed senior executives based on diversity, equity, and inclusion, DEI.
DEI metrics removed. That aligns with other administration priorities we've seen.
Correct. And remember, back in June, the administration put out guidance encouraging agencies to rate fewer employees generally as high performers and to move faster on disciplining or removing poor performers. This fits that pattern.
So fewer high ratings overall.
Right. But OPM did say that because fewer people would get top ratings, the amount of performance awards, the bonuses for those truly deserving top performers should increase significantly.
Bigger bonuses for a smaller group at the top.
That's the idea. And one more thing, back in February, OPM updated the actual SES performance standards. They made adherence to the president's policies the most critical element of their review.
Adherence to policy is the most critical element, more critical than, say, mission execution or leadership.
That's what the update indicated. It was a direct response to an executive order from Trump's first day in office aimed at restoring accountability to the SES. So when you put all these changes together,
it looks like a fundamental reshaping of how senior career leaders are judged, prioritizing policy alignment, using force distribution, bigger rewards for fewer people.
Exactly. The clear insight is a move towards politicizing the career service, changing the criteria for success for the government's top managers, potentially prioritizing loyalty and policy adherence over other traditional merit principles.
Okay, switching gears from OPM's internal reforms to external concerns about its capabilities, there seems to be some anxiety about a big new health program for postal workers.
Yes, the Postal Service Health Benefits Program, or PSHB, it affects millions of Postal Service employees and retirees. On September 15th, top Democrats from several key congressional committees sent a letter to OPM Director Scott Kupor.
Was there a concern?
They're worried OPM might not be fully ready to actually administer this massive program. And the timing is critical. We're less than 2 months away from open season, which starts November 10th for the 2026 plan year. That's when people sign up or make changes.
Not much time left. What specifically are they worried about? Where did these concerns come from?
They stem largely from a report by OPM's own inspector general back in July. The IG identified some key problems.
Like what?
Staffing vacancies, primarily. OPM figured out it needed 11 employees to manage the PSHB's central enrollment platform, the tech system, for signups within its IT office.
Okay, 11 people needed. How many do they have?
Only 3 are currently filled.
3 out of 11. That's not good. Why so many vacancies?
The IG report points to people leaving through things like the deferred resignation program and also the ongoing federal hiring freeze impacting OPM's ability to backfill roles.
And funding.
That's the other issue. OPM had requested a budget anomaly, basically. Extra funding outside the normal process to support the program rollout. They didn't get it. OPM says it found additional internal savings. But the lawmakers in their letter still called out what they saw as continuing budget issues.
So it sounds like they're trying to launch this huge, critical new system with potentially not enough people and shaky funding.
That's precisely the concern being raised. It's like trying to launch a rocket with half the ground crew and hoping for the best.
What did OPM say in response to the letter?
An OPM spokesperson pushed back, stating the agency is appropriately staffed and resourced for the PSHB program and the enrollment platform. They expressed confidence that enrollees will be able to successfully complete enrollment.
Did they mention any specific steps?
They added that OPM has dedicated additional resources to the PSHB call center and met with vendors to confirm they have the capacity.
But the lawmakers aren't convinced.
Not entirely. They called OPM's steps inadequate and warned they risk coverage for thousands of postal workers and retirees if things go wrong. They also questioned OPM's long-term ability to potentially expand this PSHB platform to replace the entire Federal Employees Health Benefits, or FEHB, program's old system, given the current struggles.
So what are they demanding from OPM?
They gave OPM until the end of this week to explain its plan to actually get those 11 employees hired, to detail its contingency plan if the enrollment platform fails during open season, and to explain how it will ensure proper funding in the next budget cycle.
They want answers fast, especially since OPM is expected to announce the 2026 premium rates for both PSHB and the regular FEHB program soon, right? By the end of September.
Exactly. The timing is incredibly tight. The insight here is just how precarious the rollout of a critical health program for millions can be, and how staffing and funding issues within an agency like OPM can have very real-world consequences for people's health coverage.
We're also seeing some big hiring shifts at the IRS. Moving away from full-time roles, toward seasonal ones, this was reported around September 12th.
Yeah, a significant change in their strategy for hiring customer service folks ahead of next year's tax filing season.
What exactly did they change?
Well, they had hiring notices out for about 4,500 full-time contact service representative jobs. They expected to fill those this summer. They pulled those notices down.
Pulled them down entirely. So, what's the new plan?
Now, they're focusing on hiring just over 2,150 frontline customer service positions. But here's the catch. More than 70% of those jobs, over 1,500 of them, are for seasonal hires.
Seasonal, meaning temporary.
Essentially, yes. These hires cannot stay for more than 4 years. It's a term-limited position. The IRS is holding hiring events across the country this month to try and fill these seasonal roles quickly.
So a major shift from permanent to temporary staff for customer service.
Exactly. Creating a largely temporary workforce to handle what is, let's face it, a permanent need for taxpayer assistance.
How has the union reacted? The National Treasury Employees Union, NTEU.
Not happy. Chapter 66 leaders called it a bait and switch. They're pointing out that these term appointments generally don't count towards career tenure.
What does that mean for the employees?
It means it's much harder for them to qualify for competitive service rights, basically, job security, and the ability to easily transfer to other permanent federal jobs. They don't build up the same status as career employees.
So it limits their long-term prospects within the government.
Right. Matt Hoffman, the chief negotiator for that NTEU chapter, said it greatly limits the employees' rights and their confidence in maintaining their newly acquired position. He argued it forces them to trade stability and career-building rights for a position with a definitive end date.
Can these seasonal employees ever become permanent?
It's possible, but difficult. They can only be considered for conversion to full-time career status after they've completed at least 2 years of work as a term employee, and only if they're rated as fully successful. So it's not guaranteed, and it takes time.
What about the remaining positions they are hiring for? Are any permanent?
Only about 600 are full-time lead and supervisory contact representative positions. And crucially, those are only open to internal candidates, including people affected by previous workforce cuts.
So no new permanent entry-level hires from the public?
Not in this batch, no. The 1,520 seasonal positions are open to the public and internal folks. And they're using direct hire authority to speed things up, aiming for decisions in 40, 45 days.
Which is much faster than usual federal hiring.
Less than half the typical 101-day average, yeah.
This shift towards seasonal work, it's happening against a backdrop of major staffing cuts at the IRS already, isn't it?
Absolutely. Under the Trump administration, the IRS has lost over a quarter of its workforce. Through layoffs, voluntary separation incentives like early retirement or deferred resignation.
Over 25% loss. How many taxpayer service staff specifically?
More than 8,600 taxpayer services employees have left. That's about 20% of the staff in that area.
And the National Taxpayer Advocate warned about this.
Yes, back in June, they warned Congress that taxpayers could see delays in next year's filing season because of these major staffing cuts. The system is already strained.
Did the IRS ask for funding to hire more people?
They did. For their fiscal 2026 budget request, the IRS said it needs to hire 11,000 call center reps just to maintain the current, arguably inadequate, level of phone service.
11,000 needed just to tread water. What happens if they don't get them?
The IRS warned they'd only be able to answer about 16% of phone calls next year.
16%. That's a abysmal service.
It would be. But the House Appropriations Committee moved forward with its spending bill without those funds for the 11,000 hires, and with deeper overall IRS budget cuts than the administration even proposed.
So Congress isn't funding the needed staff. Is the hiring freeze still affecting the IRS too?
Yes. The government-wide hiring freeze was extended until October 15th. But the original executive order actually specifies an indefinite freeze specifically at the IRS until certain departments decide lifting it is in the national interest, so the IRS is under tighter restrictions.
Wow. So budget cuts, staffing losses, a hiring freeze, and they're shifting to seasonal workers.
Mm.
Plus, they have to deal with tax code changes.
Right. They're also scrambling to get their workforce and IT systems ready for the Meiji changes from the big, beautiful bill that was signed earlier this month. Some of those changes take effect next year. It's immense pressure on an agency that seems to be getting hollowed out.
The overall insight here seems pretty bleak for taxpayer service. This shift isn't just a hiring tactic. It feels like a move that actively undermines the long-term stability of the workforce and the agency's ability to function. potentially creating a real crisis next tax season.
That's a very real possibility. It seems designed to weaken the agency's capacity, whether intentionally or not.
Amidst all these cuts and changes, there was one piece of news about pay. Most federal employees are apparently set to get a 1% pay raise in 2026. Report on September 15th.
Yes, a 1% raise is slated for most feds next year.
1%? That seems pretty modest, given inflation and everything else.
It is modest, and it comes against that backdrop we've been discussing: broader economic concerns, major workforce upheavals. Sharon Block from Harvard Law School's Labor Center, she assessed the situation around Labor Day, September 15th.
What was her take?
She described it as an incredibly difficult Labor Day for American workers generally, pointed to a softening labor market, making it harder to find secure jobs or ask for raises, and that anxiety gets magnified during a period of inflation.
So workers feeling squeezed.
Right. And Block also criticized what she called the administration's hostility to American workers, citing things like taking away collective bargaining rights from federal workers, a war on the labor movement.
So the insight is that this 1% raise, while better than nothing, feels almost symbolic when viewed against wider economic insecurity and policies perceived as weakening worker protections. It barely keeps up with rising costs.
Exactly. It doesn't do much to alleviate the pressure many federal employees and workers generally are feeling right now.
Okay, this focus on the federal workforce, the pressures, the politics, it brings us to another really high-profile story. A major lawsuit filed on September 15th.
Yes, former federal prosecutor Maureen Comey is suing the U.S. government.
Maureen Comey, daughter of former FBI Director James Comey.
That's right. She's seeking reinstatement to her job as a prosecutor and wants a declaration from the court that her firing back in July was unlawful and unconstitutional.
What grounds is she suing on? What's her allegation?
She claims her dismissal was purely for political reasons, either because of her father, who's obviously been a very vocal critic of President Trump, or because of her own perceived political affiliation and beliefs, or both.
Did the Justice Department give a reason for firing her at the time?
According to her lawsuit, no explanation whatsoever. The firing email she received just cited boilerplate language. Pursuant to Article 2 of the United States Constitution and the laws of the United States. No specific cause given.
So her suit basically says there's no legitimate reason. It must have been political.
Pretty much. Her lawsuit states, quite directly, defendants have not provided any explanation whatsoever for terminating Ms. Comey. In truth, there is no legitimate explanation. It's a very direct challenge to the administration's justification or lack thereof.
What was her track record like as a prosecutor? Was she controversial or underperforming?
Quite the opposite, by all accounts. She successfully prosecuted hundreds of cases since joining in 2015, consistently received outstanding performance reviews.
Outstanding reviews.
Mm-hmm.
And the timing of her firing.
Also striking, it came the day after her supervisors had asked her to take the lead on a major public corruption case.
The day after getting a major case. That looks suspicious.
It certainly raises questions. And there's another angle, apparently. A right-wing internet personality, Laura Loomer, had been actively campaigning online to get her fired.
So there's public pressure from certain political corners. Was Comey involved in any politically sensitive cases herself?
She was considered a rising star, definitely involved in high-profile work. Prosecutions against Jeffrey Epstein, Ghislaine Maxwell, Sean Diddy Combs, even Senator Bob Menendez. She wasn't handling low-level stuff.
So a highly accomplished prosecutor fired without explanation right after getting a big case, with political pressure swirling.
Exactly. And the lawsuit argues this has broader implications. It notes her firing came amid what it calls a spate of dismissals of prosecutors by the Justice Department without explanation.
Raising alarms about political interference in DOJ.
Yes, and about the strength of civil service protections against politically motivated firings. Her suit specifically alleges violations of the Civil Service Reform Act, which prohibits firing for discriminatory reasons like political affiliation.
What kind of damages is she claiming?
She claims adverse harmful effects, things like lost job opportunities, reputational harm, because background checks might now show inaccurate and false information related to her termination.
Did she get any indication internally about why she was fired?
According to the lawsuit, her former U.S. attorney, Jay Clayton, reportedly told her the order for her firing came from Washington.
Came from Washington. That fuels the political interference narrative.
It certainly does. The insight here is that this isn't just about one prosecutor, however high profile. It's shaping up to be a critical test case about the independence of the Justice Department, about whether federal prosecutors can be fired for political reasons, and how vulnerable civil service protections really are against political purges.
Okay, let's shift our focus from the executive branch and the workforce over to Congress. Things seem pretty tense there too, right? Short calendar, rising tensions, and this looming government shutdown threat. October 1st isn't far off.
No, it's not. And the atmosphere on Capitol Hill, as reported on September 15th, is definitely fraught. Part of it is security concerns.
Security? Why specifically now?
Well, members are reportedly worried about their personal safety, their family safety. It follows a string of really disturbing events. The killing of conservative activist Charlie Kirk out in Utah, the shooting of President Trump himself last year in Pennsylvania, and even killings of lawmakers in Minnesota. It's created a climate of fear.
That's understandable. Is anything being done?
House Speaker Mike Johnson, the Republican from Louisiana, addressed it directly. He said, "Members of Congress are safe. They will be kept safe. They have security measures now at the residence and personally. We can always enhance and do more and do better."
And the administration is asking for funding.
Yes, the Trump administration wants $58 million in increased funding, specifically for the U.S. Marshals Service and for Supreme Court security.
Is there agreement on that security funding?
Seems to be some unity on addressing that, yes. But on almost everything else, the partisan divides are as strong as ever, making legislative progress really difficult.
Speaking of partisan moves, the Senate did something pretty dramatic on September 15th regarding nominations. The nuclear option.
Yeah, they passed a rules change, often called the nuclear option. It's designed to fast-track Trump administration nominees.
How does it work?
It allows the Senate to confirm nominees on lock, basically, in big groups with just a simple majority vote.
Instead of the usual higher threshold.
Right. It bypasses the 60 or 67 votes that are traditionally needed for major rules changes or overcoming filibusters for nominees.
Does this apply to all nominees? Like cabinet secretaries or judges?
No, primarily sub-cabinet level nominees, not cabinet secretaries or lifetime judicial appointments. But still, it affects a lot of key positions.
How did Democrats react?
They weren't happy, lamented that it poisons the well for future cooperation. But they also kind of acknowledged, well, this could benefit us if we regain power down the road.
So it cuts both ways. What's the immediate impact?
It's expected to really speed up the confirmation of many of Trump's nominees. We could see a lot of them getting into their jobs in the next couple of weeks. It significantly weakens the minority's ability to slow things down.
Okay, back to that shutdown threat. October 1st deadline. The calendar looks really tight.
Extremely tight. Congress is supposed to be in session this week. Then they're out next week for Rosh Hashanah. Then they're only scheduled to be back on September 29th and 30th, right before the fiscal year ends.
That leaves almost no time for negotiation if things go down to the wire.
Very little wiggle room.
Yeah.
And the core issue driving the standoff is deeply partisan.
What is it?
Democrat Senate Leader Chuck Schumer, House Leader Hakeem Jeffries, they're insisting on extending the Enhanced Affordable Care Act, the ACA, premium credits.
These were the extra subsidies put in place during COVID.
Exactly, and they're set to expire soon. Democrats are drawing a line in the sand, threatening a government shutdown if those credits are included in any stopgap funding measure, a continuing resolution, or CR.
How are Republicans responding to that threat?
GOP leaders, Speaker Johnson included, seem prepared to call the Democrats bluff. They might try a test vote on a short-term CR, maybe funding the government just into mid-November.
Would that short-term CR include anything else, like that security funding?
Probably. It would likely include funds for lawmaker security, which has that bipartisan support. President Trump weighed in too, urging Republicans via social media to stick together and blaming Democrats in advance for any potential shutdown.
Is there any talk of passing some regular spending bills instead of just a CR?
There's some chatter about maybe packaging a CR with three of the smaller, easier annual appropriations bills, perhaps agriculture, FDA, legislative branch, military construction, and then dealing with the other nine later. But that requires agreement, too.
So if they can't agree on anything by October 1st,
then we get a partial government shutdown. Agencies running out of funding will have to close non-essential operations.
And the stakes on those ACA subsidies are pretty high. What happens if they don't get extended?
It's very high. The Congressional Budget Office, the CBO, ran the numbers. They estimated that if those subsidies expire, the number of uninsured people in the U.S. would jump by 2.2 million in 2026.
2.2 million losing coverage?
And then 3.7 million in 2027.
Wow. That's a lot of people potentially losing healthcare access over this budget fight.
It really is. When the CBO projects millions losing insurance, it's not just an abstract number. That's millions of families potentially facing huge medical bills or delaying needed care. The human cost is significant. So the insight here is a Congress under immense pressure, internally with safety concerns, externally with the deadline, battling over fundamental policy with really tangible consequences for millions, all while the clock ticks down.
What about the big defense policy bill, the NDAA? Where does that stand?
The National Defense Authorization Act, well, the House passed its version last week. It included some interesting add-ons, ornaments as they sometimes call them, repealing the old authorizations for use of military force, the AUMFs for Iraq from 1991 and 2002, and also a contracting overhaul bill called the SPEED Act got attached.
Okay, and the Senate version?
Technically, it's still being debated, but the Senate's been much more focused on getting those nominees confirmed using that new rules change. So less visible action on the NDAA itself recently.
Is the NDAA tied to the September 30th deadline?
No. Typically, the NDAA aims for completion by the end of the calendar year, December 31st. So there's more time for that one, but it's still part of this crowded and contentious legislative agenda.
Okay, let's transition over to defense contracting specifically. There was a big development with the cybersecurity maturity model certification, the CMMC program, right? The final rule came out.
Yes, on September 15th, the Defense Department finalized the core rule for CMMC. This has been years in the making. It's meant to standardize cybersecurity practices across the entire defense industrial base, basically any company that does business with DoD.
So what does this final rule mean in practice? When does it kick in?
It's likely to become officially effective around November 10th. And from that date, DoD can start putting CMMC requirements into actual defense contracts.
So every new defense contract will require CMMC certification starting in November.
Not quite automatically. It won't be in every contract immediately. The CMMC program office is going to review contracts and apply the requirement where they deem it appropriate, phasing it in over the next 3 years or so.
Why the slow rollout? If cybersecurity is so important.
Part of the reason is the sheer strain on the market for CMMC assessors, the companies that can actually conduct the required third-party audits and certifications.
There aren't enough of them.
Nowhere near enough, currently. There are only about 75 to 80 companies capable of doing these specific third-party assessments right now.
Okay. And how many companies need assessing?
DoD estimates over 100,000 companies in the defense supply chain will eventually need these assessments.
75 assessors for over 100,000 companies. That's a massive bottleneck.
Exactly. It's like needing a very specific, complex inspection for every house in a large city, but only having 75 qualified inspectors. It creates a huge imbalance and is a major challenge for implementing this quickly and broadly.
Were there any significant changes in this final rule compared to the draft proposal?
Yes, one notable change. The proposed rule had required companies to notify their contracting officer within 72 hours if they somehow fell out of CMMC compliance after being certified.
Okay, a quick notification requirement.
Right. The final rule removed that specific 72-hour notification requirement.
Why? Does that mean companies don't have to stay compliant?
No, they still have a duty to remain continuously compliant, and they still need to get recertified periodically. So the underlying obligation is still there, just not that specific immediate notification if they temporarily slip up. Maybe it was seen as too burdensome or difficult to track in real time.
You mentioned a potential wrinkle in the timing for certification, something about proposals versus awards.
Yeah, it's a bit complex. The rule says contractors need to be assessed or certified upon award of the contract.
Okay. Seems straightforward.
But when companies submit their proposals, they often need to include a unique ID number for the specific IT system that has been assessed. What if a company is in the process of getting assessed when they submit the proposal, but expects to have the certification by the time the contract is actually awarded? Will they be disqualified at the proposal stage for not having the number yet?
Ah, I see. A potential timing mismatch between needing proof for the proposal versus getting certified by the award date. That could be tricky for companies.
It could add another layer of complexity and stress to the bidding process, especially with that assessment bottleneck we talked about.
So, given all this complexity and the high stakes potentially being ineligible for contracts, what's the advice for defense contractors right now?
Experts like Eric Crucius, a lawyer who specializes in this area, are giving pretty clear advice. First, be proactive. CMMC is ultimately a verification program. Companies should already be implementing the required cybersecurity controls based on existing NIST standards. Don't wait for the assessment to start getting your house in order.
Makes sense. What else?
Seek help, but be careful. There are legitimate companies out there that can assist with compliance, often economically, but vet them carefully. And crucially, get in line now for an assessment.
Because of the bottleneck.
Exactly. Crucius mentions some assessment companies are already booking 6 to 9 months out. If you wait too long and can't get assessed in time, you simply won't be eligible for contracts requiring CMMC. It's that simple.
This sounds like it will have huge ripple effects down the supply chain, too. Prime contractors worried about their subs.
Immense pressure. Large prime contractors know they could lose massive contracts if their key subcontractors aren't compliant. So they'll be pushing hard down the chain. We might see different strategies emerge for how primes manage and verify their subs' CMMC status.
Are there resources available for companies trying to figure this out?
Yes. The Defense Acquisition University offers training. There are other free resources online too, but again, Crucius advises verifying the source to make sure you're getting accurate information. CMMC is a critical step for bolstering defense cybersecurity, no doubt, but the insight is that its implementation faces enormous practical hurdles that could significantly reshape the defense industrial base and potentially lock out smaller companies who can't navigate the cost and complexity.
Okay, moving from defense specifics to broader federal IT challenges, there's ongoing talk about modernizing federal systems, but it seems like there are persistent roadblocks.
Definitely. Norm Literini wrote a commentary on September 15th about this very issue, focusing on the idea of a true mission partner environment, or MPE.
MPE, what's the vision there?
The vision is a secure, agile, digital workspace where federal agencies can collaborate seamlessly, not just with each other, but also with civil society groups, international partners. Think secure, shared digital tools.
Sounds like a good goal. Does the tech exist?
That's the frustrating part. Literini argues the technology does exist. But the actual MPE remains out of reach.
Why? If the tech is there.
He says the problem isn't technical, it's procedural. Specifically, federal acquisition processes how the government buys things. He argues they're stuck in the past.
How so?
They heavily favor big established vendors and rely on these massive traditional contracting vehicles, IDIQs, BPAs, these big umbrella contracts.
And the problem with that is?
It often shuts out smaller, more innovative companies offering commercial off-the-shelf or FIATS solutions. These ready-made tools might be perfect for the job, cheaper, faster to deploy, but they can't even get considered because they're not on the big contract vehicles.
Literini calls this the cost of convenience.
Exactly. Relying on those big contracts seems convenient for procurement officers, but he argues it leads to problems.
Like higher costs.
Yes, higher price tags, often driven by the large vendor's overhead. Also, you tend to get custom-built systems designed just to meet the specific language in the contract, which might not actually meet the real operational needs of the users.
And it takes longer.
Often, yes. Extended timelines for rollout and integration. Plus, you get high costs and vendor lock-in for ongoing support, maintenance, upgrades. Agencies, as he puts it, end up paying more to get less. It's like insisting on a custom-built car when a reliable, readily available model would do the job better and cheaper.
So these COTS tools, these off-the-shelf solutions, they could meet the need for this MPE. Secure collaboration, data sharing, compliance.
He argues yes. Commercially validated, affordable COTS solutions are available right now. They're already tested, proven in the market, faster to deploy, more cost-effective.
But the barrier is just getting them bought. Access.
Well, primarily access. Many aren't on the existing contract vehicles, and the procurement rules make it really hard to buy them outside those traditional processes.
So what's Literini's proposed solution?
A fundamental shift in mindset. Move from being procurement-driven to being mission-driven in acquisition.
What would that look like?
Creating pathways for these emerging and non-traditional vendors to compete. Allocating smaller, more flexible pots of money for agencies to rapidly test and deploy promising COTS tools. And crucially, abandoning the assumption that higher cost always means higher quality or better security.
So MPE is achievable, but the government needs to change how it buys technology.
That's his core argument. Mission agility requires procurement agility. The insight is that bureaucratic acquisition processes are a major bottleneck to federal IT modernization and innovation, costing taxpayers more and hindering the government's ability to adapt quickly.
Let's look at a specific agency grappling with this, the Defense Logistics Agency, DLA. They handle supplies for the military. they're facing budget cuts, right?
Yes. Reported around September 12th, their FY 2026 budget request is slightly more than 2025, but it's almost a $50 million cut compared to FY 2024. Yet their mission keeps growing.
So doing more with less, essentially. How are they approaching that?
They've laid out three main priorities, or sets, for how they'll allocate their resources. These build on their existing strategic plan pillars: people, posture, precision, partnerships.
Okay, what's the first set?
Set the agency. This focuses on transforming their workforce. The goal is to make employees better at understanding and using data to work faster and smarter.
Moving people from manual tasks to more analytical work.
Exactly. DLA has about 24,000 employees, mostly civilians. They want to shift them towards more mission-critical thinking.
Are they using AI to help with that?
They are. They currently have 56 AI models, either in development, testing, or actual use. And significantly, all of these AI projects came from use cases generated by employees themselves.
So bottom-up innovation.
Seems like it. They're also emphasizing developing citizen developers, equipping regular employees with the tech, tools, and skills to solve problems they encounter on the ground, rather than waiting for central IT.
Interesting. What's the second priority?
Set the globe. This is about empowering logistics globally. Having a forward-leaning posture, especially in the Indo-Pacific region, Indo-PACOM.
Meaning getting supplies positioned correctly.
Right. Ensuring the joint force worldwide has the materials and capabilities they need for readiness and resilience. Positioning fuel, food, repair parts, medical supplies, and also building resilience in the industrial base so they can respond quickly.
Makes sense. And the third priority?
Set the supply chains. This is about modernization. DLA has 9 different separate supply chain systems. They want to modernize and integrate them.
To get better visibility.
Exactly. Create a common digital thread so they can see inventory from the factory to the foxhole, as they say. Improve data integration, responsiveness, resilience. Manage cyber risks across the chains.
What are the expected benefits of that modernization?
Better inventory management. Improved financial auditability, better customer service, maybe leveraging technology like you see in, say, Amazon fulfillment centers, and ultimately better forecasting and planning, especially for older weapon systems where parts become obsolete. Buying ahead of need, meeting customer requirements more effectively. The overall insight is seeing how a critical logistics agency, even facing budget pressure, is aggressively leaning into data, AI, and modernization to try and future-proof its operations and maintain global readiness.
Another agency heavily investing in IT modernization, particularly with AI, is the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office, USPTO.
Yes, reported September 15th. This really highlights the work of Jamie Holcomb, who just recently left after nearly 7 years as USPTO's Chief Information Officer, their CIO.
What was his main focus? USPTO has that huge backlog of patent applications, right?
Exactly. Around 600,000 applications a year. Holcomb focused intensely on using technology to tackle that mission challenge, make the process more efficient.
What were some of the key changes under his leadership?
A big one was shifting away from managing their own infrastructure, getting rid of on-premise data centers, old mainframes, legacy databases. They moved towards outsourcing more.
To use newer tools.
Right. The goal was to leverage the most advanced tools every 3 to 5 years by using cloud services and other providers rather than being stuck maintaining old hardware.
Did they invest significantly in this?
They did. About $43 million in the first year just to stabilize the existing infrastructure. Then another $150 million over 4 years to really modernize systems and applications.
Did he change how they managed IT projects too?
Yes, fundamentally. Changed how USPTO viewed technology itself, treating it as an asset that needs constant modernization. He instituted a product team model.
How did that work?
It paired business unit leaders with technical architects for specific projects or products. These teams were reviewed quarterly and decisions were made. Continue funding, adapt the project, or terminate it if it wasn't meeting mission goals.
So tighter alignment between IT and the actual business needs of examining patents and trademarks.
Exactly. More accountability, less tolerance for IT projects that drift or fail to deliver value.
And they're using AI quite a bit.
Heavily. USPTO employees now have access to several AI tools to help review documents, reduce administrative burdens, cut down on clerical work.
Trying to automate the routine stuff.
Seems like it. The agency also put out a request for information, an RFI, basically asking the tech industry for ideas on how to further improve efficiency in the patent and trademark examining process. looking for IT improvements, robotic process automation, RPA, new code, new ideas.
Are they using the newer generative AI like ChatGPT style tech?
Yes, for things like code assistance, refactoring old code, and importantly, translating old legacy code to run in the cloud. Initial pilots last year showed GenAI could translate old code with about 80% accuracy.
80% accuracy automatically. That could save a lot of time and effort.
Huge potential savings. So for the acting CIO who's taking over, Deborah Stevens, the priorities remain clear. Continue rolling out a zero-trust security architecture and accelerate that legacy code modernization using these GenAI tools. They're aiming to cut translation time for some code from 3 weeks down to just 3 days.
From weeks to days. The insight here is just how aggressively some agencies, like USPTO, are embracing AI not just for flashy projects, but to tackle core operational backlogs and modernize fundamental government processes.
Beyond those big tech initiatives, there was a flurry of other federal news items cropping up around September 15th as well.
Okay, let's run through some of those quickly. Concerns about facial recognition at ICE.
Yes, 9 Senate Democrats sent a letter to the Acting Director of Immigration and Customs Enforcement, Todd Lyons. They want ICE to halt the use of its mobile facial recognition app called Mobile Fortify.
What does the app do?
Apparently, it allows ICE agents on the street to identify people they encounter by scanning their faces against multiple federal databases.
And the senator's concerns are?
They're asking if the app is being used to surveil protesters and whether commercial data, like from data brokers, is being fed into the system. Big privacy and civil liberties questions there.
Okay, what else? OPM trying to modernize its own HR systems again.
Yes, attempt number 3, I think. After 2 previous failed efforts to replace its old HR systems, OPM is trying a more traditional procurement approach this time.
Issuing an RFI.
Right. Asking vendors for feedback on their plans for a cloud-based core human capital management, or HCM, system. They envision it as a long, 10-year, firm, fixed-price contract. The RFI details requirements across 9 areas, like talent management, analytics, compensation, benefits.
The fact that OPM, the government's HR agency, has repeatedly failed to modernize its own HR systems seems ironic. And maybe symptomatic of deeper issues in federal IT procurement we were just discussing.
It certainly highlights the challenges, doesn't it? A stark reminder that even fundamental government operations struggle with digital transformation.
Also, a new bill introduced related to federal internships.
Yes. Senator Andy Kim, a Democrat from New Jersey, introduced the Pipeline to Service Act.
What's the goal?
To try and level the playing field for college grads entering federal service. Mm. A key part is providing a stipend to pay all federal interns, even those outside the formal pathways program. Right now, not all federal internships are paid.
Making internships more accessible to students who can't afford to work for free.
Exactly. The bill would also codify the Presidential Management Fellows Program, PMF, which is a prestigious leadership development program that President Trump had canceled earlier this year. So trying to rebuild that pipeline for federal talent.
Okay, and updates on cybersecurity frameworks at DOD.
Yes, DOD's Chief Information Officer, Katie Arrington, announced they'll unveil the 10 commandments of their new Risk Management Framework, or RMF, in the coming weeks.
A new RMF. What's the focus?
The emphasis is on continuous authority to operate, trying to speed things up, get technology integrated within months, days, weeks, instead of getting stuck in the traditional 2-year valley of death for approval. They also plan to finalize a new department-wide instruction on cybersecurity by the end of November.
Sounds like trying to become more agile, similar to the acquisition reform ideas.
Definitely part of that broader push.
Leadership change at USDA's IT shop.
Yes. Gary Washington, who's been the CIO at the Agriculture Department for nearly 8 years, is moving to a newly created role, Chief Innovation Officer.
Okay, so who's the new CIO?
Sam Berry. He's been a senior advisor on government efficiency at USDA since May. He inherits a pretty large IT operation, budget over $2.7 billion, though most of that, 71%, is for just keeping current systems running, operations and maintenance.
And finally, a concerning report about military housing oversight.
Yes, a Defense Department Inspector General report found that the military services are not properly overseeing privatized military housing.
Not overseeing it how?
Military housing officials weren't correctly performing inspections when families move in or out. They were skipping critical safety checks, things like windows, electrical outlets, smoke, and carbon monoxide detectors.
That sounds dangerous. Why were they skipping checks?
The report found the housing offices often lacked sufficient staff and equipment. And they frequently fail to even document reviews of repairs made by the private housing companies.
So lack of resources leading to potential safety hazards for military families?
That's the finding. The IG recommended the Assistant Secretary overseeing housing issue better guidance on how to properly conduct these inspections using the required checklist. Just a reminder that even basic oversight functions can falter without adequate resources and attention. Even these smaller news items, taken together, they really paint a picture of ongoing tensions over technology, efficiency, safety, civil liberties, and the fundamental health of the public service pipeline.
Okay. Let's move our focus to Tuesday, September 16th itself. We saw some significant developments in economic and trade policy that day, specifically the formal implementation of that big U.S.-Japan trade agreement we've heard about.
That's right. The Commerce Department's International Trade Administration published the official notice in the Federal Register. This put the tariff-related parts of the agreement into effect, with the new rates becoming official as of September 16th.
So this makes the policy announced earlier by the president legally binding.
Exactly. It formalized the directive from the president's September 4th executive order. And interestingly, on the same day, September 16th, we got some key economic data releases that provide the first real context for this new policy environment.
What kind of data?
The Bureau of Labor Statistics, BLS, released the U.S. import and export price indexes for August 2025. This is important because it's the first report covering the period after the administration's new global tariff structure started to take effect. It gives an early glimpse at potential price impacts.
Okay, import-export prices. Anything else?
The Bureau of Economic Analysis, BEA, also released its report on the gross domestic product, GDP, for Puerto Rico for the year 2023, provides a baseline for that specific economy.
So this U.S.-Japan agreement implementation, it's really cementing a key piece of the administration's America First economic policy, isn't it?
Absolutely. It's a cornerstone. The core of it is establishing this new baseline tariff of 15% ad valorem, meaning based on the value of the goods on the vast majority of imports coming from Japan.
15% on most things, but wasn't there a change for cars? Japanese cars faced really high tariffs before, right?
Yes, that's a significant part of this deal. The punitive Section 232 tariffs on Japanese automobiles and auto parts, which were at 27.5%, are now reduced down to that new 15% baseline.
So a cut for cars,
yeah.
But a new 15% tax on almost everything else that might have been lower before.
That's the basic structure. The administration consistently frames this as necessary to level the playing field for American producers, shrink the trade deficit, and boost domestic manufacturing.
And that economic data, the import-export prices, that gives us the first hints of whether this policy is actually leading to inflation.
It's an early indicator, yes. Still incomplete, just 1 month's data, but critical for tracking those immediate price effects. The insight here is that we're seeing a major restructuring of trade with a key partner driven by this specific economic philosophy, and the real-world consequences, winners and losers, and impacts on your wallet are just starting to become visible in the data.
What are economists predicting as the broader impact of this kind of tariff regime?
Well, independent economic analyses generally project that applying broad tariffs like this will likely lead to higher consumer prices here in the U.S.
Yeah, much higher.
One analysis estimated that an overall tariff regime along these lines could result in an average income loss of about $2,300 per U.S. household just in 2025. Due to higher prices for imported goods or goods made with imported components.
$2,300 per household. That's a significant hit for many families. What about the impact on Japan?
It's definitely a mixed bag for them. Reducing those car tariffs from 27.5% down to 15% is a huge relief. The auto industry is massive for Japan, over 21% of their exports. They were reportedly losing an estimated $20 million per day under that higher tariff rate.
$20 million a day. So cutting that tariff is a big win for their auto sector.
A major win. However, for almost everything else, that new 15% baseline tariff is still much higher than the rates that existed before these trade tensions started. So it will likely continue to put pressure on many other sectors of the Japanese economy.
And didn't you mention something about the tariffs being applied retroactively?
Yes, that's another interesting wrinkle. The new rates were applied retroactively to August 7th, 2025, which means importers who paid the older, higher rates between August 7th and September 16th might be eligible for refunds.
Refunds are good, but that retroactive application sounds kind of disruptive for businesses trying to plan.
It absolutely underscores the disruptive and uncertain environment international businesses are operating in right now. constantly having to adapt to sudden, sometimes retroactive, shifts in trade policy.
Could you quickly recap the key tariff changes again, just the highlights?
Sure. For most Japanese imports, the rate goes to 15%, unless the existing rate was already higher. Previous rates varied, often much lower. Importantly, tariffs are not stacked. The 15% replaces other general tariffs. It's not added on top.
Okay.
Cars, automobiles, and auto parts go from 27.5% under Section 232 down to the new 15% baseline. This replaces the Section 232 tariffs specifically for Japan.
And the exemptions.
Yeah.
0% tariffs for some things.
Right. Aerospace products, but not drones, go to 0%. Generic pharmaceuticals, including ingredients and chemical precursors, go to 0%. And certain natural resources that the U.S. doesn't have enough of also go to 0%. These specific carve-outs show some strategic thinking within the broader tariff policy, protecting certain supply chains or inputs.
Okay, let's shift back to institutional stress within the government. September 16th was also the day FBI Director Kash Patel was scheduled for a big hearing, wasn't it? His first oversight hearing before the Senate Judiciary Committee since his confirmation.
Yes, a highly anticipated and potentially contentious hearing. It was set against this backdrop of escalating criticism about his leadership.
We talked about the Maureen Comey lawsuit, but there were other issues swirling around him too, right?
Oh, yes. Remember, Patel is a staunch Trump loyalist, came from a political aid background, not career law enforcement. His confirmation itself back in February was narrow, 51-49. And ever since, he's been plagued by accusations of politicizing the FBI.
So this hearing was a major test for him.
Huge. And the context was critical. There's that politically explosive lawsuit from the three former senior FBI officials, Driscoll, Jensen, and Evans, alleging he fired them for improper political reasons.
The allegation that he admitted he was told to fire people who investigated Trump.
Exactly. A bombshell allegation suggesting a direct political purge. That alone would make for a tense hearing.
But there was also controversy over his handling of a major investigation.
Yes, his public handling of the investigation into the assassination of Charlie Kirk. This really damaged his credibility, even among former supporters.
What happened there?
Just hours after the shooting, Patel posted on social media that the subject is now in custody. But that turned out to be false. The person they initially detained was released. The actual suspect was still at large.
A major public misstep in a high-profile, fast-moving case. How did that go over inside the Bureau?
Terribly. Current and former agents reportedly saw it as completely unorthodox, premature, and damaging to the FBI's credibility. It highlighted his lack of experience in handling sensitive investigations and public communications around them.
Were there other internal issues, morale problems?
There were also reports emerging around that time of Patel lashing out at agents, supposedly in profanity-laced tirades. This kind of behavior, true or not, contributes to eroding morale and trust within the workforce.
So you have the lawsuit alleging political firings, the public fumble on a major case, reports of internal turmoil. Is he facing criticism from all sides?
Pretty much. Not just from Democrats and FBI veterans, which you might expect, but also from elements of his own right-wing political base.
Why? From them?
They've questioned his competence, his perceived failure to deliver on promises, like releasing certain documents related to the Jeffrey Epstein investigation that they wanted made public.
So pressure from everywhere. It sounds like a genuine crisis of confidence in FBI leadership.
Absolutely. This convergence of issues put Patel in what was described as a precarious position. He was seen by many observers as crumbling under pressure, creating a dangerous leadership vacuum at the nation's top law enforcement agency, precisely when stability might be needed most. The insight here isn't just about one director's performance. It's about the potential for severe damage to the FBI's operational integrity and its political independence.
What are the potential long-term impacts if these issues aren't resolved?
Well, the lawsuit and the whistleblower accounts, if true, suggest a systematic purge of officials seen as disloyal. Ranking member Dick Durbin, the Democrat from Illinois, stated bluntly that these actions have greatly weakened the FBI's ability to protect the country from national security threats.
Weakened national security capabilities. That's serious.
Extremely. And the public turmoil risks a catastrophic drop in morale among the rank-and-file agents and a collapse of public trust in the FBI's ability to do its job impartially. So Patel's testimony was seen as a really critical moment, not just for his career, but for the future credibility and effectiveness of the FBI itself.
Okay, let's look at the regulatory agenda for September 16th. Any significant actions on immigration or public health?
Yes, a couple of notable items. On immigration, U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services, USCIS, published a notice in the Federal Register.
What was it about?
It was inviting public comment on the reinstatement, with change, of an information collection related to something called the public charge bond.
Public charge bond, what is that?
It's actually a long-standing provision in immigration law, though maybe not always frequently used. It allows an immigration officer to grant admission or a green card to someone they think might become a public charge, meaning reliant on government assistance if that person posts a financial bond.
Yeah.
Usually a minimum of $1,000.
So a way to let someone in who might otherwise be deemed inadmissible on financial grounds if they put up money.
Exactly. And the fact that the administration is formally reviewing and reinstating this with changes signals a renewed emphasis on using this tool.
What's the likely impact of using it more?
Well, a more robust and frequent application of this rule could create significant new financial hurdles for immigrants, especially those with low or moderate incomes. It signals a potential shift towards a more restrictive immigration system that puts a heavier weight on an applicant's financial standing. Critics might argue it favors wealthier immigrants.
Okay. And what about public health? Something happening with the Vaccine Advisory Committee.
Yes, the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices, or ACIP. This is the expert panel that makes recommendations on vaccines for the CDC. On September 16th, HHS and the CDC formally announced the appointment of 5 new members to ACIP.
New members being appointed sounds routine. Why is this significant?
Yeah, because it's the latest step in what's been a really controversial overhaul of this committee. Back in June 2025, the HHS Secretary, Robert F. Kennedy Jr., basically reconstituted the entire committee, wiped the slate clean, and started appointing new people.
Why does he do that? What was the stated reason?
The administration's stated goal was to restore public trust in vaccines, which they claim was lost during the Biden era.
Restore public trust. How has the medical community reacted to this overhaul?
With considerable alarm. Major medical groups like the American Academy of Family Physicians, the American College Health Association, they've expressed serious concerns.
What are their specific concerns about the new members?
Critics point out that several of the newly appointed members have previously expressed views skeptical of vaccines or have publicly questioned the severity of COVID-19.
So appointing people with known vaccine skeptical views to the top vaccine advisory body.
That's the charge. And it's led to widespread fears that ACIP's recommendations might no longer be based purely on objective gold standard science, but could be influenced by political ideology instead.
What are the potential consequences if that happens, if the committee's recommendations become politicized?
Potentially severe. You could see a slowdown in the approval and recommendation of new needed vaccines. You might even see existing proven vaccines removed from the recommended schedule.
And if a vaccine isn't on the recommended schedule,
that could lead to a loss of mandatory insurance coverage for those vaccines under the ACA and other rules, which means people would have to pay out of pocket, reducing uptake. And overall, it could further erode public confidence in immunization programs generally at a time when public health officials feel that confidence is already fragile. The insight here is the potential politicization of a crucial scientific advisory body, risking tangible public health outcomes and trust in science itself.
Finally, let's look at what Congress was up to on September 16th, specifically the House committees. The full House wasn't voting, but the committees were busy.
Exceptionally busy. While the House floor was quiet, the committees held at least 9 different hearings that day, a really packed schedule.
9 hearings in one day. Was there a common theme emerging?
Very much so. Looking at the hearing topics, it reveals a pretty coordinated and thematically consistent oversight agenda driven by the House majority.
Focused on what?
Primarily on advancing deregulation, scrutinizing actions taken by the previous Biden administration, and also examining some emerging national security threats.
Can you give some examples? Deregulation first.
Sure. The Energy and Commerce Committee held 2 relevant hearings. One was titled Appliance and Building Policies, Restoring the American Dream of Homeownership and Consumer Choice. This looked at bills aimed at rolling back energy efficiency standards for home appliances.
Okay, reversing efficiency standards. What was the other one?
From Gridlock to Growth, Permitting Reform Under the Clean Air Act. The goal there was clearly to find ways to streamline environmental reviews for big industrial projects, make it faster and easier to get permits.
And scrutinizing the previous administration.
Yes, the Oversight and Government Reform Committee held a hearing titled From Protection to Persecution, EPA Enforcement Gone Rogue Under the Biden Administration. The title alone tells you the goal. Build a case that the previous administration misused the EPA's enforcement powers.
What about resource extraction? Aligning with administration goals there, too.
Yep. The Natural Resources Committee held a hearing on unleashing Alaska's extraordinary resource potential, clearly supporting the administration's push for expanded domestic energy production. And the Small Business Committee looked at government-backed lending in a hearing called Pathway to Capital, the Role of SBA Lending in Supporting Main Street America.
Were there other topics covered besides economic and environmental regulations?
Yes. Hearings also touched on national security issues like the threat of agro-terrorism and the rising threat of malicious drone use in America. Plus, they looked at college pricing reform and even geoengineering.
So this dense schedule of hearings, it wasn't just random activity. It served a purpose.
Absolutely. It serves a clear political and legislative purpose for the majority party. To build a public record that justifies the administration's deregulatory agenda. To conduct aggressive oversight, often critical, of the previous administration's policies. And importantly, to lay the legislative groundwork for future policy changes. These hearings provide a platform for stakeholders who support the administration's goals, and they help create a narrative to advance specific bills and executive actions down the line. The insight is that these committee hearings are far from just academic discussions. They were strategic tools used by the congressional majority to shape policy, justify their agenda, and build momentum for legislative action. Hashtag tag 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 outro.
Okay, wow. Let's try and process all of that. We have covered an incredible amount of ground just looking at 48 hours of federal activity.
It's really something. From interventions on the streets of Memphis to legal strikes in international waters to the intricate, sometimes baffling world of federal employment rules.
Not to mention global trade shifts, defense strategies, institutional stress at places like the FBI. It's clear the U.S. government is going through a period of really intense transformation. And a lot of political tension.
And what's truly fascinating, I think, is seeing the connections, how these seemingly separate events are actually quite interconnected.
How so?
Well, you see this consistent, robust use of executive authority across the board, trying to impose a very distinct vision on law and order, on national security, on economic nationalism.
And that assertion of power often bumps up against established norms, challenges institutional stability.
Exactly. It impacts everything from, individual civil liberties in Memphis to global trade relationships with Japan to the basic structure and morale of the federal workforce itself. It's all part of this larger unfolding story about who holds power in D.C. and how they choose to wield it.
So connecting it back to our listeners, what does this all mean for you sitting at home? Well, it shows how decisions made in Washington really do ripple outwards, right?
Absolutely. They affect potentially your healthcare premiums via the ACA fight. They affect the safety perceptions in communities, rightly or wrongly. They affect the stability of the job market, especially if you're a federal employee or contractor. And even the future of technology in government, how agencies serve you.
These aren't just abstract policy debates happening in vacuum. They have real, tangible effects on daily life, on the economy, on the very fabric of society.
Which really raises a huge question for all of us to think about.
Yeah.
As the federal government asserts its power so forcefully across so many different areas, and as key institutions like the FBI or advisory panels face this unprecedented stress, how do these rapid shifts reshape what we even mean by governance? What does accountability look like in this new landscape?
Yeah, how is the definition changing? It's definitely something to keep considering as these stories continue to develop, as these new precedents get set. They can really alter the balance of power, the way things work, for years to come.
Food for thought, definitely.
Indeed. We really encourage you to keep following these developments, dig deeper into the stories that interest you, and consider those long-term implications. Thank you so much for joining us for this deep dive into the federal news update for Tuesday, September 16th, 2025.
Always a pleasure to break it down. Hope it provided some valuable insights.
Until next time, stay curious, stay informed, and keep seeking out those aha moments.